In an empire where Congress knows nothing, the ubiquitous DC think tank is all. And the Israel lobby and their neocon allies must own a dozen. Well, Americans have a lobby in Washington, too. It's called the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They advocate for us on Capitol Hill. Join CNI to demand an end to the U.S.-sponsored occupation of the Palestinians and an end to our government's destructive empire in the Middle East. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Check out scotthorton.org for all the stuff, etc. All right, first up today is Alex Kane. He's a great writer, assistant editor over there at Mondo Weiss. That's mondoweiss.net. If I may be a little bit broad brush, if you're not familiar, I think it's more or less fair to say that Mondo Weiss is basically the headquarters of ex-Zionist liberal Jews in America who are just over it now, pro-one-state solutions or that kind of attitude, rather than old pro-Jewish state, and not controversial for any good reason, really, but very controversial, very important website. And I hope you all will bookmark it and keep a very close eye on it. It's Phil Weiss, Alex Kane, Adam Horowitz, not the Beastie Boy, another guy, and a lot of other really great writers there. MondoWeiss.net. Welcome back to the show. Alex, how are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming back on the show. I really do appreciate your time. Can you please give us all the lowdown, good news and bad, and whatever is most important we need to know this morning out of the Gaza Strip?
Over the past 3 days, there was a ceasefire between Israel and the armed Palestinian factions, including Islamic Jihad and Hamas. And so there was no fire for the past 3 days. And this ceasefire expired this morning at about 1 a.m. our time, Eastern time, which is, you know, 8 a.m., I believe, in Gaza. And so there have been a few incidents throughout the ceasefire of sort of fire going back and forth. You know, Israel opened fire on people in Gaza inspecting a park in a neighborhood near the border with Israel, and reportedly there were two mortar shells fired within this ceasefire period, although they didn't hurt anybody, and the Israeli fire didn't hurt anybody either. But this morning, Islamic Jihad Islamic Jihad fired rockets into Israel, and Israel returned fire with airstrikes, killing about five people today already. So, however, there are tentative reports of perhaps another ceasefire coming into play very soon at 8 p.m. local time in Gaza. So we will see if that happens. Negotiations are reportedly still ongoing in Cairo, and I'm saying reportedly a lot because a lot of this is kind of up in the air right now and tentative. There's not a lot of concrete information coming out, but it does seem that, you know, talks about a longer term ceasefire are still going on. And although the two sides, Israel and Hamas, are at loggerheads, basically the dispute comes down to Israel wants Israel and Egypt, actually allies in this, want Hamas to demilitarize, meaning, you know, give up their arms, which is basically not going to happen. That is asking Hamas to commit political and military suicide. Hamas and actually the Palestinian people want principally a lifting of the air, land, and sea blockade that Israel has imposed on Gaza since 2007. Mm-hmm. So, you know, fighting has resumed, not as intense as it has been over the past month, but you know, it's unclear what will happen right now.
All right. Now, on the question of the talks in Egypt, who all's even participating in those talks? Is Hamas invited, or they've just got the Qataris sitting in for them, or what?
No, Hamas is invited, along with the Palestine Liberation Organization. So you have all of the Palestinian factions negotiating.
Well, that's good, at least. I mean, because this last ceasefire, I guess, maybe I'm wrong, Alex. I guess I had thought that this last ceasefire that they had accepted it, but they didn't even really get to help agree to the terms in the first place. Sort of like the first non-offer they can't accept that they tried to pull a couple of weeks back.
That's right. That's right. In the first couple of days when Israel launched its devastating assault on Gaza, Israel and Egypt Egypt unilaterally announced this ceasefire, and Israel automatically agreed. Now it seems reports after that indicate that, you know, Israel and Egypt were in constant communication before this assault and also during the beginning of the assault. And so, you know, basically why Israel accepted it is because what they want is quiet from Gaza without disrupting the status quo of blockade, of the economic strangulation of the Gaza Strip that has been going on since 2007, and which is kind of a root cause of why there's been so much bloodshed in Gaza. And so Hamas said, look, you know, you can't have a ceasefire, and I think they're absolutely right about this, you can't have a ceasefire when you didn't actually talk to the opposing party that's also firing rockets and mortars, right? So Hamas said, we learned about the ceasefire terms through the media, and we're not going to accept this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Hamas rejected that sort of ruse a couple of weeks ago, and the fighting escalated from there. This time, it seems like Egypt may have changed its tactics and, you know, convinced Hamas to cease fire for at least, you know, 3 days. To get negotiations going on in Cairo, which is what's happening right now.
I see. So in other words, the ceasefire that's expiring right now that we hope can be prolonged despite these aberrations of Islamic Jihad firing off a couple rockets and Israeli retaliation, that this ceasefire itself was sort of a unilateral thing too, that Hamas didn't really negotiate. But now they're negotiating. Do I understand it correct then?
Well, Hamas agreed to stop firing, and so did the other Palestinian factions, 3 days ago.
Oh, I see. That was it, though. That was all that they had agreed to.
Yes.
I see.
They only agreed to 3 days, and yesterday they said, you know, if the ceasefire expires without any of our demands met, then, you know, we will continue to fire into Israel, and that's exactly what they did. Mm-hmm. We should say that, you know, these are legitimate demands of Hamas. I mean, they're simple. They're not even, these demands are not about the overall Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This is just related to the Gaza Strip. Hamas and the Palestinian factions, they want a lifting of the blockade. They are backed by the Palestinian population in this. You know, people in Gaza want to live. They don't want to be prisoners anymore. That's what Hamas is trying to do. They're really in a bind. Hamas is in a bind, really. Israel and Egypt want to crush them, or at least really weaken them. They really want to weaken them bad, although they don't necessarily want to overthrow Hamas. Mm-hmm. They want to weaken Hamas bad and not change anything from how it was before this operation. They want to keep it. They want to keep the situation as it is, as it was from 2012 to 2014, which essentially, you know, no firing from Palestinian factions, meaning that, you know, southern communities in Israel can live, you know, in peace. But the blockade was kept in place. You know, Israel routinely sort of bombed Gaza and did, you know, tank incursions into Gaza occasionally, and so on. And the occupation of Gaza continued. So for Hamas and the Palestinian people, it was not so much quiet. It was a slow death, as they have said over the past weeks. They say, you know, better a fast death than a slow death is how some Palestinian factions explained why they were fighting.
Right. Yeah, you know, Sheldon Richman and I went over the proposal from Hamas from, I guess, 2 weeks ago, where it was included a 10-year truce, but also had their list of demands. And it was all like, please let us trade and have a seaport. And so there's no typical hostage type demands in there. Just the hostage itself, asking to please be set free, is really enlightening. Just seeing what their list of demands is really casts a relief on their situation. I'm sorry, we got to take this break. Please, everybody, hold it right there. We'll be right back with Alex Kane from MondaWeiss.net.
Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm talking with Alex Kane from MondoWeiss.net. MondoWeiss.net. And we're talking about the state of the negotiations and the would-be, could-be ceasefire. I don't know. Andrea Mitchell, Alex, just tweeted out that the war is back on. The ceasefire is over. And the talks in Egypt weren't going anywhere anyway. And so forget it. Which I guess, assuming that that's true, I kind of want to ask you, I'm not sure how to set this up right, really. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, they want, their demands now are that Hamas has to commit, you know, complete hara-kiri and give up all their weapons and all of that kind of thing. It makes me wonder whether the Israelis have accomplished anything here other than getting a bunch of coffins sold, you know, in the local Gazan economy here. Because, like you said, they don't want to get rid of Hamas because, you know, I don't know if they hired some outside expert from somewhere, something to look 2 weeks into the future and wonder, well, who might come next after we get rid of Hamas and might they be worse, which is unheard of in Israeli politics, I think. But wowee, looking 2 weeks out, that's great. So they don't want to get rid of Hamas. They know they can't get rid of every last rocket because the rockets are just plumbing pipe and household chemicals, so there is no rocket infrastructure to get rid of, you know, the tunnels, of course, can't all be found, and then they can be recreated in the blink of an eye, and most of those were for trade and not fighting anyway. And so what in the hell is the point of any of this if all they have now is, okay, well, so you have to give up your life, you have to all, here's your, you know, Rambouillet style offer you can't possibly accept, and now we're going to bomb you some more.
Yeah, well, just one thing, the tunnels between Israel and Gaza were for fighting, I should say. The tunnels from Egypt into Gaza were for smuggling goods and weapons as well. But,
sure, but that was the super majority of the tunnels anyway, right? I mean, how many were even headed toward Israel at all?
Right, I think the number that Israel says that they destroyed about 35.
I guess that's
tunnels.
Possible, you know.
Yeah, but you're right that the vast majority of the tunnels were on the Egyptian side, although many of them were also destroyed when General al-Sisi came to power in Egypt. But to get back to your original question, you know, this is, you know, we saw this in 2009 after Israel unilaterally withdrew from Operation Cast Lead. They, you know, they're sort of one of their main goals is, in the very crude Israeli parlance, you know, mowing the lawn, sort of, which is a very racist term, I think, dehumanizing Palestinian people as merely grass to be mowed. But this is a euphemism to say that they want to restore their deterrence with Hamas, meaning that they want to pummel Gaza so bad that the Palestinian factions will cease their fire because they know that they can't militarily win, and also because they want to, you know, they don't want to subject their population to bombardment. But, you know, this isn't a permanent solution, and eventually the Palestinian factions do resume firing because of the crippling blockade that is strangling Hamas and other factions. And Israel, you know, Israel put their goals, they were fairly modest goals, but I don't think they've met all of them. I mean, when they first started the air campaign, which was how this war first started, they said that they want to have quiet for quiet, meaning that, you know, they want to degrade Hamas's rocket capabilities. Now, the news that a Palestinian faction sort of shot rockets today, and you know, and the fact is that Hamas does have rockets that they can still fire. I mean, they're largely ineffectual, but they can still be fired, and it does place Israeli civilians, you know, in a sort of state of fear. You know, that objective simply can't be met. I mean, there's no way that the Israel can destroy without a total reoccupation of Gaza and going house by house and you know, door by door, et cetera, and to destroy every last rocket that they find. That's just not going to happen. The other goal was to destroy the tunnels, and they claim that they have destroyed a lot of them. But you know, you're right that the tunnels can be rebuilt. So, is there, you know, basically, I think a lot of Israelis are also asking this question: what was really the point? And you have right wingers in the Israeli cabinet pressuring Netanyahu, saying you didn't go far enough. You know, we have to crush Hamas, we have to overthrow them, we have to reoccupy Gaza and make sure that no rocket will ever be fired into Israel again. That is also untenable, really. I mean, the question is, I think the reason why we didn't see a full reoccupation of Gaza and even a larger incursion to Gaza, because the Israeli troops only went sort of into the border, the neighborhoods and the towns right on along the border with Israel. They didn't go into Gaza City with troops, right? They knew that if they went into cities further into Gaza, that more soldiers would be killed, and perhaps they would raise the risk of a captured Israeli soldier, which Israel does not want at all. So that's a totally legitimate question. What really did Israel accomplish? Not much. But again, what did Hamas really accomplish? Not much, right? Right now, you know, the what Hamas wanted is a lifting of the blockade, or at the very least, and that doesn't seem to be on the table right now.
Well, you know, the funny thing about that is, you know, not the people of Gaza, but Hamas, in a sense, is in a superior position when they act smart in their asymmetric warfare, because, like you're saying, yes, their goal one is to get Israel to lift the siege and to, you know, let them have their, you know, somewhat independence there and eventually a state and all of that. But their second order goals are to, if you're not going to go for that, then go ahead and sabotage yourself by attacking us, which is exactly parallel to Al-Qaeda terrorism against the United States, or for that matter, IRA terrorism against the English. It's to provoke a reaction. Or first of all, it's to get you to wise up and leave us alone. And if that won't work, then we'll provoke you into overreacting and hurting yourself that way, judo style. And so that's what Hamas has succeeded in doing, is firing rockets over Israel enough to make every Israeli afraid, even if their lives aren't really in danger. It disrupts their whole fantasy that they live in a normal country in a normal time over there. And at the same point, I hate to give the Likudniks, you know, credit on this, but I'll give them, you know, a quarter of a point or something, that they are actually kind of right, that civilian casualties serve Hamas just the way that civilian casualties serve the American Empire, or serve the same way the rockets serve Benjamin Netanyahu in solidifying support and helping to generate new support for, you know, the people that are their base. And so, you know, Netanyahu has played right into Hamas's hands. He says what they want is civilian casualties, and then he has the tanks launch all their artillery shells at neighborhoods. So, you know,
that's true.
It's like Bush invading Iraq.
That's true. Although I should say that I'm not quite so. I don't think civilian casualties boost Hamas's support. I think that, you know, the civilian casualties do sort of make the population enraged at Israel. That is true. But if the population of Gaza thought that Hamas wanted, you know, civilian casualties in Gaza, I think that Hamas would lose support. It's a tricky kind of an analysis, but right.
Look at Al-Qaeda in Iraq, even go back a few years to the days of the Bush War. Zarqawi would bomb a Shiite marketplace full of women and children. Why? To get the Shiite militias to attack other Sunnis, to get the other Sunnis to go ahead and join up with Zarqawi. Now, it's bad PR for him, and yet effective.
Right.
So, with 9/11. It's all about, you know, overreaction. Trying to provoke one. But anyway, I mean, hell, point is that, in fact, and I've seen on Twitter where people are saying, Hamas isn't the one bombing me, Israel's bombing me, Hamas are the ones defending me, right? These are people who are newly won over to the Hamas cause, basically, civilians of Gaza, saying, well, Hamas is all I've got, so I guess I like them.
Right. And, you know, if you talk to people in Gaza, it's not even so much like Hamas itself. It's they refer to it, you know, as the resistance. Right. You know, they say, you know, it's not a question of Hamas. And many people in Gaza don't agree with Hamas's Islamist politics. It's not a question of supporting Islamic Jihad. Of course, some people in Gaza are sort of rank and file supporters of Hamas and so on. But right. I'd say the vast majority of people, you know, don't want that. And you know, they refer to it as a resistance. And the resistance, you know, the Palestinian factions are united together, whether they're left wing or Islamist, right. and united in sort of waging battle against Israel.
It's not just that they're firing rockets over the wall. You know, their casualties are Israeli troops who have been shot by resistance, Hamas or otherwise, fighters in Gaza, mostly with rifles and with, you know, short-range artillery in battles inside the Gaza Strip. So it is, you know, I'm not necessarily recommending any tactics for any side, and I sure as hell don't support Hamas's even existence in any way or anything like that. But it absolutely, I wouldn't want to imply that I don't think that the people of Gaza have the right to defend themselves. I'm not sure firing rockets over the wall is defending themselves, really, but certainly firing rifles at invading soldiers is.
That's true, and if you look at the casualties, it really gives lie to Israel's claim that, you know, Hamas is this awful terrorist organization that wants to kill every Israeli civilian. I mean, I think if Hamas had the capability to kill many more Israeli civilians, as they did during the Second Intifada, they probably would.
Yeah.
But the fact is, during this war, the vast majority of Israeli casualties, about 64, were Israeli soldiers. And you look at the civilian death toll in Gaza, it's the complete opposite. The vast majority of casualties, according to, you know, UN statistics from Palestinian human rights organizations, and so on, say that the vast majority of casualties were civilians, including about maybe 400 children, many women, and so on. So that makes Israel take a big hit image-wise worldwide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and that's a whole other topic I had here to talk about in the notes, but maybe I will go ahead and ask you one quick question about it. What do you think about this? Is something that Phil Weiss is always talking about, is the change in the narrative. Well, first of all, do you really agree that the narrative is changing? And then if so, what do you chalk that up to? Because this war is no more brutal, really, than Cast Lead or 2012, whatever, I forgot what they called that.
Right. Well, I actually think this war is even worse for Israel than Cast Lead. I mean, Cast Lead was sort of the first straw for many people, and you had many sort of left-leaning Jews say, forget Israel, you know, this needs to end, this is horrific, the white phosphorus raining down on Gaza and so on. But this attack was even more brutal if you talk to people in Gaza. You know, whole cities were leveled. Beit Hanun, Shujaya, a neighborhood in Gaza City, these places were leveled. And, you know, it's awful for the people of Gaza, and they have to rebuild, and there's hundreds of thousands of people displaced and so on. But I think Israel's image around the world, and even in the U.S., is worsening. I think, you know, Phil and other people talking about this narrative shift, I don't think it's incremental. It's not a huge shift.
Sure.
You know, much of the corporate media is still, you know, kind of sort of buying into much of the Israeli narrative, but there are sort of glimmers of light in media coverage. And also, you know, you look at this striking poll that came out a couple, I think last week or maybe a week and a half ago, detailed how young people, if you're between the ages of, you know, 18 and 40, you think Israel's actions are unjustified in this war. I see this, you know, with my own coverage of, you know, people protesting in New York, which is where I'm based, you know, and even within the Jewish community, you have this sort of a total disgust with Israeli military operations, and people don't think that it's justified. They, you know, how can you, you know, any rational person looking at this, even if you're not politically aware, mm-hmm. you look at the pictures from Gaza, the civilian casualties, you can't but help but say, this is crazy, this needs to stop, and Israel is unjustified in what they are doing.
Right.
And I think that that's what people are coming to, you know, that's the conclusion they're coming to. Now, the Congress is far behind. I mean, you had a Senate vote 100-0. Just that, it's incredible. 100-0 backing Israel's assault on Gaza. Now, you know, so the trick is to translate this groundswell of support for Palestinians into political change. You know, people are some people are giving up on Congress and they're turning to civil society, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement targeting Israel, and that's only going to grow after this. Whether that will actually really change the calculus is another sort of question.
Right.
It hasn't changed the calculus yet, but people want to act right now. Congress is totally out of touch with young people, at least. And so, you know, there's good and there's bad in terms of the whole question of narrative shifting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, all very good points. I would only add that, because I think maybe it'll be helpful, and this is something that Phil and I have talked about for a long time now, is what exactly is it that turns the key in people's brain? And I think what it really is that unless you really look into it, you don't really get to understand. You might hear the term, but they don't ever explain on TV, especially, about the occupation, that Gaza and the West Bank were conquered back in 67. They already lost back in 67. So, like I like to say on the show starting recently, this isn't like even a battle against the Plains Indians. This is a battle against Indians in their reservation 20 years, 40 years after they've already lost the Plains Wars. This is a canned hunt. This is, you know, people who are already beaten and occupied still being shot. It's not the country next door. It's an occupied territory. And I think that the difference on Twitter is, or for the young is, you know, first of all, like you're saying, the images of what all is going on, it's not having to be filtered through what Dan Rather wants to show us or that kind of thing anymore. But it's also that young people on the internet are exposed to just premise one, there's an occupation going on here. Now let's talk about what else is happening on top of this occupation, which is a completely different narrative than everybody's grandma and grandpa has, which is that it's poor little Israel, land of Holocaust survivors, penned against the ocean with their back to the sea, surrounded by hostile enemies. They're the ones in the Gaza Strip, surround, you know, occupied and bombed, is what the old people think. And they've just got it all upside down. And I think that's the difference that the internet makes, is people can really understand the fact to the occupation, and once they do, there's just no way around who's zooming who here, you know.
That's a really great point, and the regional equation has so changed. I mean, that narrative.
Oh crap! I'm sorry, I'm so over time. I gotta go. Thanks, Alex. You're great, man. Appreciate it.
Yep.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
All right, that's Alex Kane, everybody. He's at alternet.org and at mondoweiss.net.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at scotthorton.org/Amazon. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com.